News of Europe's massive bailout to prop up the Greek economy may have helped boost stock markets around the world this week, but as deficits balloon here at home, many wonder how long it's going to be before we find ourselves in the same leaky boat. New York Times columnist David Leonhardt says there are important differences, but like the Greeks, our government spends more than it takes in. Like the Greeks, Americans enjoy ever more generous government benefits, and nobody seems to be ready for the hard choices of less spending and higher taxes. So how about you? What are you willing to pay for more for or willing to give up to avoid a Greek-like crisis here in the U.S.? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. David Leonhardt joins us now from the studios at the Christian Science Monitor here in Washington. You can find his front page column from today's New York Times through a link at our website, npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you say that for any number of reasons, the United States is unlikely to face the same crisis as Greece, but nevertheless, the trend is pretty scary.
That's right. So the reasons we're unlikely to face a Greek-like crisis we can probably put into two different categories. One, our fiscal situation is not as bad as theirs, according to most estimates. There's some people who think it is, but I don't think it's as bad as theirs. And the second is that we have strengths, political and economic strengths. We control our own monetary policy. We have a currency that a lot of people want to hold. But having said all that, there really are parallels here. And the fundamental problem is the same, even if the degree of it is not. And that problem is that we essentially have created a government that we're not paying for. And we like to talk about the idea of, oh, well, if only we could get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse and these terrible politicians and all this stuff. But the reality is that's not the main problem. And the main problem isn't the war in Iraq, as expensive as it's been. It's not the stimulus program, as much money as that has cost. It's this long-term disconnect between the fact that, on the one hand, we like Medicare, we like Social Security, we like having a strong military, and on the other, we don't like paying the taxes to support all those benefits we want.
Interesting article in USA Today, which reported that the tax rate last year, at the end of last year, was the lowest since 1950.
That's right. The main reason for that is during a recession, tax collections go down because people's income goes down. And also the government put in some one-time tax breaks. But it's also a reflection of the fact that essentially every economic group has had their taxes cut over the last 30 years. The very rich have gotten the biggest tax cut in terms of tax rates, but really everyone's gotten some kind of tax cut. And so that's why revenues are such a low percentage of GDP combined with the recession. And the kind of government we have is not shrinking by any means. It's growing.
Your colleague at the New York Times, Paul Krugman, wrote a blog since your column came out today. Does he throw that into arguments, by the way? Does he ever throw – Pulitzer Prize winner. Excuse me, Nobel Prize winning economist.
Nobel Prize winning.
Nobel Prize winning.
Even better.
Does he throw that every once in a while to settle the arguments?
I mean, he's based in Princeton most of the time.
So he's
still a professor.
Too much. Yeah.
I see him occasionally, but actually more not at the times than at the time.
But anyway, he questions your calculation of how far the U.S. debt will. You say Greece's debt is about 115% of its gross domestic product today, that you project the debt to equal, the U.S. debt to equal 140% of gross domestic product within two decades. And he says, well, that's based on a lot of faulty and very pessimistic projections.
Yes, although in the end, I think we actually agree. He may not agree, we agree. But he basically said that he takes issue with the notion that we are similar to Greece. And so to some extent, that is a matter of semantics. I agree things aren't as bad in this country as they are in Greece. But I still think they're quite serious. And I apologize if my memory's off here. I think it's the very last sentence of that blog post. Paul says that we would essentially need a fiscal adjustment equal to more than 6%.
That's what he says, yeah.
GDP. Yeah. That's a really big deal. I mean, more than 6% of GDP is getting close to $1 trillion in today's terms. Now, we don't need to make that adjustment immediately, but that's a really significant adjustment. So I'm happy to, for the sake of the debate, agree that an adjustment of 6% of GDP would solve many many of our problems, and then we can move on to the issue of how do we actually get there, and we can leave aside the question of does an adjustment of that size make us Greece or not Greece.
Well, and let's get some input from listeners on how we get there. The two options seem to be cut spending or raise taxes. What would you be willing to give up? What would you be willing to pay more for to avoid a Greece-like problem if it is something along the lines of a trillion? And when you say $1 trillion, $1 trillion a year or $1 trillion over the course of how many years?
Well, it's a year, although, again, it's not something we need to start doing immediately.
All right.
The really serious deficit problems, there are really two deficits. There is the short-term deficit that's been created by a combination of the recession, mostly the Bush administration policies, which are basically big tax cuts, two wars, and the Medicare prescription drug benefit. And then third on the list in terms of size is the stimulus program, the Obama stimulus. And so that's the short-term deficit. That starts to shrink over the course of the decade, but sort of just on schedule, we then get the real problem, which is we start to get the long-term Medicare and, to a lesser extent, Social Security deficit growing. And so that's why over the long term we need to look at this kind of fiscal adjustment that's in the neighborhood of something like 6% of GDP, and that is every year.
And when you're talking about the Bush tax cuts, they are set to expire. There are going to be a lot of people arguing to keep them in force. You don't cut tax, you don't increase taxes effectively during a recession. But anyway, that's another argument, and I guess that's part of the argument. Let's get Clint on the line. Clint's calling us from Moultrie in Georgia.
Yeah, that's right. What I'd be willing to give up is a black budget like defense spending. You know, from what it seems to me, it seems like, you know, we're spending undisclosed amounts of money to fight, a Cold War era style war, you know, when, you know, the truth is that we're no longer, we're no longer in that kind of like conflict, you know.
When you're talking about black budget, you mean the stuff that we don't know about that's buried in somewhere?
Yeah. You know, the stuff that like the undisclosed like defense spending is what I'm talking about.
It's buried somewhere. I mean, we do know about it. We just don't know what we're voting for when we vote for it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, defense spending, whether black or overt, David Leonhardt, can you get $1 trillion a year out of that?
You can't, but it's big. It's now in the neighborhood of $650 billion. One of the real problems with defense spending is that it has already been shrinking quite significantly as a share of GDP. I don't remember the numbers exactly off the top of my head, but it's a few percentage point of GDP down from where it was. So if it's 650 now, that is in the neighborhood of 4 to 5% of GDP, and that is way down. And so it's way down from the Cold War and the Vietnam War era. And I think we would all agree that we need some kind of military, right? And we probably want a pretty strong military based on the seriousness of the threats that there are around the world. So,
yeah, but an appropriate military.
So could you cut $100 billion out of the military budget, which would, I mean, be really quite significant? I don't know, but I'm open to that idea. It doesn't get us anywhere close to solving the larger
10%
gap. Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I think it's an important potential part of the solution.
Clint, thanks very much for the call. Here's from Cameron, an email. I could do without two wars, cheap gasoline, and excessive profits for business. 1 year of our nation's net profits might cancel our nation's debt. It would hurt bad, but a deep depression would hurt worse. And that seems to be more a philosophical stance than exactly what he is willing to pay more for or do less with. Let's see if we can get this is James. James with us from Flagstaff.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, please.
I'd be willing to pay more for taxes. I think my wife and I are both in social services in Arizona, which is kind of a difficult situation in the state right now. And both of us have been laid off in the past year because of budget cuts in the state. And I would definitely be willing to pay more for taxes, even though, you know, our measly little social work salary doesn't give much to give up. But I think people just lack perspective of personal responsibility in economic crises.
Mm-hmm.
And they look out for their personal peace and affluency in times like this.
Well, David Leonhardt will certainly agree with you on that last point. People lack that sense of personal responsibility for the budget. You say essentially in your column, the problem is us.
I do think a big part of the problem is us. And I think I think part of the problem is politicians as well, but I think a big part of the problem is us. And one of the things that we've forgotten is the idea that we get something for our taxes. We get schools. We get the military. We get Medicare and Social Security. We get a lot of things that when you look at polling data and you just use common sense are tremendously popular. There just aren't a lot of people who want to give up Medicare, right?
Right.
One of the big parts of the healthcare debate were a lot of people in this country who have universal healthcare saying that they don't want to have to give up any of it so that other people can have universal healthcare, right? That's
right.
The over 65 crowd talking to the under 65 crowd. And so I think it's important to remember that, yes, sometimes government revenue is spent poorly. But there are also lots of times in which it's spent well. It's these popular programs. It's the fact that the private sector didn't build the internet. The government did. The private sector then built a lot of wonderful companies that the government never could have built. But the Defense Department built the internet. And the federal government built the highway system. And local schools that people say in polls they really like, those are government entities. And this incredibly successful biotechnology industry we have needed a huge amount of government funding to get off the ground. And there is a long history of societies as they get richer deciding that they want more services provided by the government. They want more healthcare. They want more education. They want more military. They want more of a safety net. And so it's actually quite natural and quite in keeping with history that as a society becomes richer, the share of its revenue that it devotes to government goes up. Our problem is that we want to have it both ways. We do want to increase the size of our economy that goes to government. We just don't want to increase the size of our economy that goes to paying for that government. And that can't last. We either have to do things like get rid of Medicare in its current form and get tax and keep taxes low, or we have to increase taxes. My sense is we have to do both. We have to increase taxes and also find ways to reduce the growth of spending in the future.
And you can to read about those calculations in David Leonhardt's column at the, it was published on the front page of the New York Times today. There's a link to it on our website at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. David Leonhardt, New York Times economics columnist. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Novelist John Edgar Wideman's newest book is a collection of short pieces, some of them as short as a page, even a sentence. The book is called Briefs, Stories for the Palm of the Mind, and Alan Chu says this review.
Stories? Not really. These 90-some easy pieces stand closer to sketches or notes or responses or notions for stories. An old black man in a wheelchair imagines himself the white woman who's pushing him along. Wideman himself imagines the last night of the novelist Ralph Ellison. Wideman attacks book reviewers. He creates little rhapsodies about walking on a New Jersey beach or walking through the French countryside. He laments with great force about family miseries. He recounts an anecdote about jogging. He engages here and there in automatic writing, eulogizes his mother's bones, lost friends, lost opportunities. In other words, he plays the hot beam of his focus on life and art, on love, race, politics, family, on the holy and the everyday, from street life to the bedroom, and much of it taking not much more time than it's taking me to tell you about what he's done. So this is a slight book from one of our country's most interesting writers. And one has to notice, and what a sign of the times this is, that it comes to us from a small print-for-hire outfit that advertises online. All this makes it interesting enough for you to give it your attention, one brief, insightful page at a time.
The book is called Briefs, Stories for the Palm of the Mind by John Edgar Wideman. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
This is NPR.
Whatever the rate of the Gulf spill, one thing became clear today. At the mouth of the Mississippi, globs of oil are now washing ashore. NPR's Kathy Lohr has the story.
There's an old lighthouse near this spot called Port Eads, the southernmost tip of Louisiana. The water around the marshy islands looks clear, but boom laid out to catch the oil tells a different story.
the oil on that boom right there.
Marine conservation specialist Rick Steiner worked on the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
These are meant to deflect oil from getting into the reeds, not to really contain it, because you can't hold a boom against a current like this and collect oil.
One strip of boom surrounds the shoreline. The second strip, which follows it like a white ribbon, is meant to absorb as much oil as possible. That strip is now turning black from the oil, and oil droplets have breached the barrier. Walking on one of the sandy islands with a group of journalists and environmentalists, Steiner immediately spots reddish-brown patches of oil about the size of a 50-cent piece. They're shiny, sticky, and gooey, and we see the oil has made its way into the base of the tall reeds.
This is stuff that has just very recently started coming to shore. It's going to keep going, certainly as long as the blowout keeps going offshore. But even if they capped it today, we've got 4 to 5 million gallons of this stuff in the Gulf, and it's going to just keep moving back and forth with the currents and the wind.
Not far away on an adjacent island, a dozen workers in white hazmat suits are mopping up oil and placing it in huge yellow trash bags. An oil sheen is also visible in the Chandelier Islands to the east, part of the Breton National Wildlife Refuge. But these marshes have also been closed to the public. The wetlands are in the farthest reaches of Plaquemines Parish, the first place where the oil has come ashore. Parish President Billy Nungesser is keeping an eye on the spill because it has tremendous environmental and economic consequences. He's asking BP to pay for a $250 million coastal protection plan.
Yeah, we need to move quickly.
Nungesser wants to dredge and build a huge barrier, an 80-mile sand berm that he says will protect the wetlands and wildlife. He says boom now being used is not enough. The coastal protection plan is something Nungesser has been pressing for since Hurricane Katrina devastated this area. But now, he says, it's urgent.
We could actually see a storm that would put this oil in everybody's backyard. We should start pumping immediately and take every opportunity we got to keep it out the marsh.
Too little, too late.
Joe Slavich and his 27-year-old son, also Joe, are oystermen. They're afraid the plan would be too late to preserve sensitive oyster beds just offshore.
It would take so long to set that up, and I expect the oil to come ashore before that. I mean, it's any day now.
Dredging operations could start in 10 days if BP and federal agencies approve. But that's a big if. Shrimp boat Captain Mark O'Brien is worried about a paycheck and about the massive oil slick, so he signed up to help with the cleanup effort. But O'Brien says he hasn't been called in yet.
I like to help. More than happy to help. And I'd rather catch shrimp, but I'll catch all if I have to.
O'Brien and others were hoping to spend the morning fishing. Instead, they're waiting. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Plaquemines Parish, Louisiana.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Around the world, American exports are under attack from cheaper competitors. But one industry is doing very well overseas, higher education. American universities are creating satellite campuses in the Middle East and Asia at a record pace. Schools see a chance to boost their reputations as international players, but they're also finding that branch campuses come with a number of risks. In the first of two reports on American schools abroad, NPR's Larry Abramson reports from the Persian Gulf nation of Qatar.
The Carnegie Mellon University campus outside the capital, Doha, looks like it should house works of art rather than students. The main building features a dramatic amphitheater with traditional Qatari seating on the floor, a cool fountain, and lots of soft reflected light. Carnegie Mellon has a total of 11 overseas campuses targeted mainly at graduates. According to Dean Chuck Thorpe, this place is different.
This is unique. This is the only place where we have an overseas branch campus teaching a four-year undergraduate degree.
Carnegie Mellon Qatar is part of Education City, a gathering of six top institutions rising in architectural splendor out of the sand. Georgetown University, Texas A&M, Northwestern, and others offer something that students around the world crave, a real American degree.
We're not like Carnegie Mellon or inspired by Carnegie Mellon. We are Carnegie Mellon.
That's what the diploma says that students get here. There's no asterisk saying you attended the campus in Qatar. That gives this place a reputation so exalted it's referred to locally as
Land of the Giants.
Saleh Al-Khulaifi, a junior, is from Qatar, as are nearly half the students here. The arrangement with the local administration gives some preference to Qataris. Sitting in the grand stone entryway of the building, he says the reputation of this American school leads to some razzing.
So everyone sees us here as the enlightened, the highly educated that will come back and change Doha or tell us, don't be so arrogant about your education. Okay, we know that you've been to a good school, but...
And that's exactly what Qatar's ruling family wants, to change this country from a tiny emirate dependent on gas reserves to an information economy. The Qatar Foundation, an endowment built on royal petrodollars, considered building its own top-flight institution. But Foundation President Mohammed Fathi Saud told me they decided that Education City was the quickest way to stem a brain drain.
We are serving a tier of students who used to leave this country and study somewhere else in Western Europe or in the United States of America.
Each of the schools here focuses on a special niche. While Cornell does medicine, Texas A&M offers engineering degrees, Carnegie Mellon's specialty is business.
I'm not quite sure what the message is here. Remember, this is valuable real estate at the top of each one of these slides. Valuable real estate.
Professor Patrick McGinnis is helping a group of students hone their presentation skills for his business communications class.
Yala, let's go.
The assignment is to present a vision for a locally based business. One group wants to compete with foreign manufacturers of chocolate.
Cornelia will be original, unique, and extraordinary because we will produce our own chocolates in our company.
They hand out samples of their product, which is delicious but is judged to be distracting. All students speak good English here, though many still struggle with business English. Other than that, the only clue that you're not in Pittsburgh anymore is the clothing. Some of the women are covered head to toe in a black abaya. Local guys wear a long white tunic called a thobe. Some are in a co-ed class for their very first time. Senior Butaina Al-Madadi says her parents were skeptical about letting their daughters come here.
This was one of the things that my father and I argued slightly about before I went to college. I think that his concern was more about the environment.
About the morals.
Yeah. But then when I came here, he encouraged my little sister to also come here. So perceptions change.
Schools here hope their presence will nibble away at prejudices about the West. They have been promised that the local administration will not interfere with the curriculum. That might not be much of a problem for engineers or doctors. Richard Roth heads the Northwestern program here. I asked him if his journalism students run into interference.
Oh, all the time. There's no Freedom of Information Act here. The reporters here don't ask questions of government, and these are the things we're trying to teach. Change is slow. The press law here is outdated.
That's just one of many things that might discourage top faculty from wanting to teach here. Why give up a cushy job with tenure in a leafy suburb to teach in the desert? Majd Saker came from the Pittsburgh campus because he wanted a new challenge.
Here, there was nothing a few years ago when it comes to this type of education and research. The impact that you have on the society, the impact that you have on education is quite significant.
Saker is originally from Lebanon. Members of the Arab diaspora see U.S. campuses here as a chance to come home again and help reestablish the region's education credentials. People who have studied branch campuses say there are few things as important as having the perfect partner. If your host starts to interfere or goes broke, your endeavor and the home university's reputation could take a big hit. Carnegie Mellon Dean Chuck Thorpe admits this kind of experiment would be difficult to pull off in an impoverished country.
When we set out to do international education, we said we have to do it right. Doing it right means finding a place that has the vision. It also means doing it in a place that has the resources.
The local foundation builds the buildings and covers all expenses and pays schools a management fee. That's a pretty sweet deal, and it appears to satisfy any concerns that these campuses might be a drain on resources. These and other offshore universities are at pains to emphasize their connection to the deep history of the home university. They offer video connections, library access, even semester visits back in the States. Nevertheless, Professor Alan Ruby, who studies this phenomenon at the University of Pennsylvania, says it's hard to compare these efforts to a full-fledged university campus.
They're essentially boutiques, without meaning anything disparaging by that term. They're very tightly focused. They keep a control on the quality of admission and therefore on the quality of faculty.
Boutiques or not, foreign schools are catching on here. Tomorrow, competition and one-upmanship in the branch campus business. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
The country's largest single employer, Uncle Sam, is overhauling its hiring process. The move follows years of warnings that the best candidates for federal jobs were being put off by a system notorious for red tape. Yesterday, President Obama ordered agencies to update a system that is literally a holdover from the 19th century. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Ian Smith has applied for numerous federal jobs in the past decade, the most recent last year.
It was a 20 or 25-step process. And one positive thing I will say is that you could save it and come back later. So that was helpful because it did take 3 or 4 hours.
Former naval officer and global studies professor Doug Padgett has been applying for jobs at Defense, Homeland Security, and other agencies. After all that effort, he says, you enter a black hole.
Most of the time, you never hear anything. I mean, 6 months down the road, you might get a letter saying you didn't get the job. And I've had that happen. I'm like, I don't even remember applying for the job at that point.
This is no joy for federal agencies either. Managers say by the time they identify the perfect person for the job, he or she is likely to have been snatched up by the private sector. John Palguta of the Partnership for Public Service says the Byzantine nature of the system stems in part from the so-called Rule of Three, a cumbersome ranking process adopted more than a century ago.
It was around 1880. But it's premised on the notion that, well, you know, we'll be able to determine who the best people are. We want to hire the best, so we'll have managers pick from among the top three.
In fact, until recently, the law said you could not hire whoever ranked four. Balguda says that may have worked for 19th century clerical jobs when a test could clearly show who had the best skills, but it's impossible to apply to the complex jobs of today.
We have great workers in government now in spite of the hiring process, not because of it.
John Barry heads the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. He announced the overhaul to a room full of grateful public servants.
For the first time in history, you will be able to apply for almost every federal job with a simple resume and a cover letter. We are eliminating knowledge, skills, and ability essays as an initial recruitment requirement of the federal government.
That would be the dreaded KSA, a series of mini essays. Government agencies will also be required to keep applicants informed of their progress. Federal hiring has been on the rise in recent years, and many more people will be needed as the baby boomers retire. So it will become all the more important not to alienate people like Doug Padgett, who says he's come up with a coping mechanism.
I take breaks. I take breaks where I don't do quite as many applications.
Padgett may want to try again in November. That's when federal agencies are supposed to have the new system in place. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Cory Booker had everything he needed to win, money, advertising, and celebrity endorsements. But what does a candidate do when he has none of those? He yells at people, out of speakers, from the top of a truck. NPR's Robert Smith was also in Newark, New Jersey on Election Day, what some consider to be the loudest day of the year.
In Newark, only the hard of hearing could possibly forget to vote. It's a political tradition here. Plaster the car with posters, strap on your home stereo, and hit the neighborhoods. Some trucks like this one have a recording. Others have live talent.
Come out and vote. Exercise your right.
I actually ran after this black Ford Econoline van cruising the South Ward of Newark.
Excuse me for a second. Can I ride along with you?
I am James Nance. I'm a retired police officer here in the city of Newark.
And he's been driving sound trucks for decades. He's almost 80 years old, and you can't buy his services. He has to love a candidate before he'll jerry-rig his sound system.
So I adapted my own type of apparatus to hold the speakers.
Yeah, it looks like you have bungee cords, and I got string wrapped around me here, sitting in the front seat.
Yes. Those are the wires there for going up to the speaker. And as you see, I had to have this contraption so I could speak while my hands are on the wheel.
All righty, it's that time, but we're going to show our power.
The thing about a sound truck is that it's not broadcasting per se. It's more amplified conversation. Nance will pick out specific people.
Hey, bro, You know Roz, don't you?
He'll tail people riding bikes. He'll yell at residents just peeking out from behind the curtains of their homes.
Hello there. This is Jim Nance, retired police officer, asking you to lend support to my colleague, Cliff Miner.
I don't know. They don't look too impressed.
You can't judge them by looking at them. Some people aren't, some people aren't.
But no one complains about the noise. Olivia Doherty even comes out of her beauty shop, Boswell's House of Coiffures. She says it would be like complaining about fireworks on the 4th of July.
And believe it or not, we look forward to this day.
Why do you look forward to this day?
To liven up the neighborhood.
It would be a very quiet election day if people just handed out literature.
Yes, and we would stay right in the house.
And that's just not going to happen if James Nance can help it. Not that he doesn't have a sensitive side. When he sees a woman pushing a sleeping baby, he backs off the mic. Just a tad.
You make sure that baby votes for Cliff Miner, okay, honey?
Robert Smith, NPR News.
This is NPR.